Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. Does it strike you as a bit suicidal on the part of the human race that we go around polluting our waters, our water resources, up to our very oceans? How are we going to survive on this planet with polluted waters? And what are we doing to the waters that are used by the rest of the life on this planet? And why do we continue doing it when we know better? That's another issue for me. We'll talk with William Marks today. He's written The Holy Order of Water, Healing Earth's Waters and Ourselves. He's placed himself in a unique position to comment on our water. He took a 2-year horseback ride of 7,000 miles cross-country from San Diego to Maine, expressly to look at what's happening with America's waters. He's gotten a global perspective on historical water management practices, visiting Europe, Australia, Ireland, North Africa, and elsewhere to look at what they did in ancient times. He's cleaned up the waters of a small harbor with Walter Cronkite. How's that for harnessing star power? And Walter says of William's books, "This is an extraordinary book, the results of one man's passionate effort to save us, to save civilization from our ignorant waste of our precious water resources." Not only that, but William has looked at the role of water in spiritual practices, vortex energy, cosmic rain, what water does for the human body. So we'll look at that as well with him this hour. Welcome, William, and how are you?
Fine, thank you, Loralee. A pleasure to be here.
What got you on this quest?
The quest, I basically feel I was born with it, since I've always had this affinity for water, intrigued by it, playing with it, as many children do. But it stayed with me as I evolved and went through college. I continued doing water studies on an extracurricular basis. And so it's been basically my mantra through my entire life.
Hmm. So do you bathe or shower?
I do both.
Okay.
I do like submersion. I do that a couple of times a week with herbs and bath salts and some essence, lavender essence oil. So yes, it's very therapeutic, and I think it's very important.
This 2-year horseback journey, when did you do that? And on horseback, I've met somebody who was riding a mule up and down the West Coast. But to take a horseback journey, I've talked with people who took a bicycle and rode through all 50 states. But how do you ride a horse across country? This is fascinating.
It was a fascinating way to see our country. I rode
Indeed.
From San Diego to Maine. I zigzagged with the weather. I covered about 7,000 miles of the United States. And by doing so, when you're traveling by horseback, I had a pack horse too, Loralee, to put my farrier tools on, some survival gear and whatnot, because I truly was living outside full time. For that 2 years.
Farrier tools are the tools that to shoe the horse.
Yes, I shoed my own horses. And then sometimes when I would pull into remote areas of the United States where people had horses and depended on them quite a bit, they would find out that I was in the area and that I knew how to shoe horses. It ended up being a way for me to make some money as I came across as well, and to meet people and to have them feed my horses and to commune with them.
Oh, boy. That's really fascinating. So you were managed to find small roadways to travel, you know, when we study a map.
Yeah.
And, of course, you can hook up and avoid major urban areas, I guess, because you're really there to study the water.
And the wildlife. I was at a stage of my life, by the way, I did this 25 years ago, I was out of college, traveled Europe and North Africa, and I returned and I was working as an environmental analyst for the city of Newark, handling their water programs, and going down to Washington to get some money for the city of Newark to clean up the Passaic and Hudson Rivers and to bring in drinking water to our city. But I left that three-piece suit job to ride across the United States.
Good for you.
Kind of like a childhood dream of sorts. I had a horse when I was a kid. I was raised on a farm.
What state?
New Jersey, northwestern New Jersey, a small town called Tawako.
So what did you learn? To summarize your journey, what did you learn about our waterways?
Well, certainly the way we are managing water, and I've kept up with it since then, in various parts of the United States through my connections and traveling and speaking, but certainly we've stressed the environment through our management, our mismanagement of water, the placement of dams, and how that has altered ecosystems. Certainly back then we were... A lot more industrial pollution was much more blatant. You'd see rivers change colors because of dyes or blood from slaughterhouses just being pumped into the rivers without any treatment. That's much rarer today, thank God. Yes, I saw those abuses. And you also see it in the wildlife, reflected in the wildlife, their access to water. Systems that were basically destroyed when you put up a dam. You have to think of those thousands of years where the ecosystems evolved depending on that water below the dam before it was constructed, and they just get wiped out. So, yeah, I saw visually and felt viscerally what our management of water was doing to the planet.
Well, nowadays, we do question the wisdom of placing dams, but tell it to the Chinese building that huge dam that's going to inundate ancient cities as well, or towns.
Oh, the Yangtze, the Yangtze River there, the Three Gorges Dam.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is a pretty scary project.
Yeah.
Moving millions of people. Yeah, and they're already forecasting that the pollution behind that dam is just going to build up once the dam is constructed, and create some serious problems. It's also flooding some very vital farmland for them. So we'll see if the Faustian bargain reflects itself once that dam is up and they start getting their electricity.
Faustian bargain, well put. Well, tell me about how you went to other countries and looked at water management practices and what you saw there. Because, you know, I think of the Romans and their aqueducts, cities that were traditionally located near sources of water, and that was their limitation. You couldn't have big cities in the historical past without having all of the necessary ingredients there. I read in the paper today the fights that California is having over the Colorado River. I've talked with people up here in the Northwest who seriously were contemplating proposing pipelines running from our waters, you know, down to California to feed them. I guess the question I have is, why do we have to use so much water anyway? Why do we have to recycle water the way that it did? Why not imitate nature? I guess there's some municipalities that are trying to do that, who are trying to say, you know, this is the way that nature purifies water through wetlands, and they have a purpose, and sand percolation and all of that. So let's take a clue from nature. And I think in the past, that's what people did, because they didn't have high tech to do it for them.
Well, well said. And yes, you know, I feel that we're entering this phase of human history where there will be this water consciousness permeating all the peoples of the planet inevitably in one fashion or another through healing and through just obtaining it, drinking water and the expense of managing it. But yes, working with nature, what you just said, Laura-Lee, is so important, and to learn from nature. Nature has its own method, its natural method for cleansing water, for filtering and purifying water. And that is so vital that we learn from it and also that we work with it to move water through pipelines. First of all, when you move it through pipelines, you are actually robbing the water of its natural energies. And then also, you're going through a great expense, money-wise, energy-wise, and you're not delivering water in its most health-benefiting condition. So, yes, what is the most cost-effective, healthy way to obtain water, and that is to obtain water at the source and to use it at the source. And that is one of the greater lessons that humanity, I feel, is going to learn at this time in history. I hope we learn it. To treat it with machines or to tow it across the ocean like they're now proposing from Canada.
They're proposing what?
To ship water across the ocean.
Oh, from Canada's more pristine sources, just loaded up in tankers where it can get polluted, just sitting there and leaching from the sides of the tanker. Gee, that's smart.
No, what they're going to do, Lorelei, is
tow icebergs? You know, what are they
doing? Well, yeah, towing icebergs. Well, they're harvesting bottled water from icebergs as we speak.
Yeah.
Where they pull up.
Gee, they're not melting fast enough on their own with global warming. Let's go chip away at them, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, they pull up with a huge ship and they anchor to the iceberg and then they go on with machinery and they harvest the ice to the mothership where it is melted and bottled. So, yeah, we're doing that. But relative to transporting it across the oceans, what they have are these floating bladders.
Floating bladders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Made of plastic.
A huge water bag, about 3 football fields in length, and they can hold hundreds of thousands of gallons of water.
Oh, well, metal, plastic, whatever you want to pollute the water with, fine, but go ahead.
Well, they fill them up and tie them together.
Yeah.
And tow them across the ocean and then anchor them offshore to the city that makes the purchase.
Uh-huh.
And then pump them out as they need their water. It's like a backup reservoir, or could even be a primary reservoir.
It's kind of diabolically brilliant, isn't it?
Well, diabolically frightening as well.
Yeah. Okay. This is what we've come to. I mean, we couldn't figure out, gee, maybe we should clean up our water years and years ago, decades ago. Maybe we could stop letting industry just wholesale pollute the water. You know, if they taxed them for polluting or prevented them by law from polluting, it wouldn't have happened. They would have found other ways to dispose of the waste or not create it in the first place. I mean, I read somewhere where someone said, engineers can do what you want. You know, they can perform pretty much miracles. You just give them the parameters. If it's cheap and pollution's okay, that's what they produce. If you say that you want these parameters, it's got to be clean, it's got to follow nature's principles, it's got to do this, they could have come up with those solutions. You know, you just give them the program and they come up with solutions. I don't know if they're that much magicians, but I do know that we didn't have to allow this to happen in the first place.
Well, yeah, as far as being magicians are concerned, one thing they cannot take out of their magician's hat is to create new water or potable water.
Yeah.
Water is a very limited resource, and that's why you see us recycling, filtering, trying to manage it as best possible with engineering. Well, you know, even in California, like in the Santa Monica area, their groundwater there was contaminated with that gasoline additive, MTBE.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's still occurring today. We're still waking up. We'll see where we go. You know, people are becoming so much more conscious. That's why you see so many people in the airports. And perhaps even you yourself walking around with those little plastic bottles of water.
Even those aren't supposed to be all that pure, you know. You read the report, some of it's just tap water. So.
Well, yeah, the Dasani and the Aquafina by Pepsi and Coca-Cola, that's refinished city water. But it's cleaner than the city water, you know, to some degree. But even the plastic bottle that the water goes into, there are various grades of plastic. And so it's important for people to be aware of the plastic that their water is in, their drinking water is in when they buy it.
That's why water is such a miraculous medium. It absorbs whatever you put it with, so it's going to leach some of that plastic.
It will. That's why there are some safer plastics than others. If you do buy your drinking water, you look at the bottom of the bottle, and you want to see a number one in the triangle on the bottom of the bottle. That's the PET. It's a polyethylene terephthalate type of plastic. It's pretty inert. You certainly do not want to see a number two inside that triangle on the bottom of your drinking water, whether it's a gallon or a quart or whatever.
Because?
That is a type of plastic. It's a high-density polyethylene plastic they call HDPE. It's more soluble in water, and you may even give impart a plastic taste to the water. So you're really taking in plasticizers into your body, which isn't the greatest of ideas.
No, it's not.
So, you know, for your listeners and yourself, if it has a number three, that's fine, too, because that's a polycarbonate type of plastic, which is pretty inert as well. So number one or number three, you know that you have a higher quality plastic that leaches very little into your drinking water.
So tell us about cleaning up the waters of Edgartown Harbor.
Well, I live on the island of Martha's Vineyard, and we have a harbor here called Edgartown Harbor. And for many years, about 30, 40 years, they would have their races here, the yacht races. And no one really ever questioned what the presence of all of those sailing vessels had, the impact it had, the environmental impact it had on the harbor. And at the time, I had a water testing laboratory here, a state-certified water testing laboratory that I owned and operated. It was called Vineyard Environmental Protection. And I received a phone call from Walter Cronkite. And you can imagine you're sitting in your office and you hear, you know, that familiar voice. But anyhow, yes, he called and we had a long chat. And he expressed his concerns about the Edgartown Harbor. And he was familiar, since he himself is a sailboat enthusiast and he has his own sailboat. But he was aware that on race day, and when the sailboats were in the harbor, a lot of people were kind of lazy, especially if they were at anchor for quite a while, and they would just dump their toilets into the harbor. And he expressed this concern. So in advance that spring, in the spring, we started doing a series of tests on the quality of the water. And these tests went through the entire spring, through the early summer. And then once the sailboats started arriving for the yacht races, we noticed a bump in the coliform, the bacteria rating in the water quality, and it increased. The numbers of bacteria increased. But then the biggest jump came on race day, and what we determined was that on race day, they wanted to lighten their load before they went out and raced, and also they didn't want their toilets sloshing around while they were racing. So they were all emptying their septic systems, their toilets, into the harbor. Pretty gross when you think about it. But the revelation of that, once we had the documentation in place and presented it to the selectman of the town of Edgartown, Walter Cronkite, walked in with the water sample evidence and presented it to them, it was pretty shocking. And the yachting community, very embarrassed, but they agreed to cooperate, and they put together a great program. They all gathered together and put together a program for pumping out the heads of the sailboats. It just takes that consciousness, Laura Lee.
It does, yeah. And knowing that everyone else is doing it, so that your efforts are also, you know, part of the whole. You know, the consciousness of it, that it's okay to pollute water, I guess, really stems back from the earliest times where, you know, hunter-gatherer societies made such little impact on the environment because there were so few of them and everything they did was natural and decomposed that, you know, it was okay. I mean, you know, dumping sewage and water when we went to the Mayan pyramids, our guide pointed out one of the earliest stone toilets that was placed strategically right over a stream that went right through the middle of a building. You know, you think, oh, clever. Too bad for the people downstream. But, you know, and you describe in your book how filthy rivers used to be at before the Industrial Revolution took place. You know, you see old movies where in the Renaissance times, people just threw their wash basins of junk out the window, and too bad if it splashed on you down walking on the street below the houses. So I think it was just an acceleration that, you know, if you're not much of a population, it's okay because the environment can handle it and recycle it. But when you get to be a huge population and when you start getting chemicals that don't break down or that do devastate the life around it, DDT and elsewhere, then it isn't okay. So I don't think that we've quite, you know, fully become cognizant of the effects. You said companies don't just put slaughter offal into the water anymore. That's so blatant. There's so many other things we're putting in the water that maybe aren't as visible, but are still polluting our water. So what is it going to take to change our consciousness? What's it going to take to really flip things around and find solutions? Do you think the solutions are readily available, William?
Well, the solutions I think that humanity is going to come up with are going to have to be on such a scale of human cooperation that it is unprecedented in human history or civilization. My feeling is that we're entering a stage of history. You mentioned the Industrial Age. And before that, you know, we had the Stone Age, the Bronze Age. We just came through, some people call it the Computer Age or the Information Age. But right now, I sincerely feel that we are entering the Water Age, the Age of Water. And this will define, and in my mind, without a doubt, many, many things relative to civilization either surviving or collapsing. And this water consciousness, which I feel is inevitable, is going to happen just because of the things you mentioned, Laura Lee, the pollution. When you cannot get water in your home, clean water in your home, or you cannot drink clean water, sad to say that about 40% of the world's population, that comes to about 2.5 billion people, are drinking water that is very unhealthy. And we're looking at, right now, over 1 million people a year dying due to poor water quality.
In what countries is happening in what's in the water that they're drinking?
A lot of it has to do in the third world countries with lack of sanitation. So you're looking at India, you're looking at Africa, you're looking at parts of China. And basically what they're dying from are waterborne diseases, you know, the cholera, the typhoid, that are transmitted through water. For instance, because of the presence of cholera in India, they've been over there trying to figure out natural ways, the huge populations that we have in India and China, for instance. How can we help the people who are out in these remote regions to sanitize their water? And, you know, it's such small things as to using low-tech to clean the water are things that are being discovered right now. For instance, in India,
you have to tell us about this when we come back, because
okay,
we will rejoin William Marks in just a moment, hear more about the uses and history of water. He's written The Holy Order of Water, Healing Earth, Water, and Ourselves. I'm Laura Lee. Let's continue our conversation with William Marks. His book is The Holy Order of Water. And you're telling us that low-tech are often, solutions are often the best solutions. Go ahead, William.
If you're in a situation in the world, yes, where that is all that is available, with applying some thought relative to the dynamics of water or working with water, you can minimize the pollutants that can cause you harm. For instance, the E. coli bacteria and the cholera, for instance. And we were talking about India, and one of the things that they discovered was, you know, the sari clothing that mm-hmm. the Indian women wear, mm-hmm. those beautiful long garments. They found out that by taking polluted water with, you know, the cholera infection in it, that if you take four layers of this cloth.
Really?
Pour the water through it and let it drain through it, that they found a great reduction. I think it was as much as 60 to 80%
wow.
of the cholera infection taking place in those communities where they used this technique. Now, what was at first bewildering to the scientist was, well, why was this filtering method working? Because the bacterium are so small that they could certainly go through the cloth.
Yeah.
But what they discovered was that the algae in the water, that the bacteria bound themselves to the algae.
It was caught by the cloth.
Which was caught by, captured by the cloth.
Interesting.
Little low-tech thing like that, as well as using a plastic bottle.
Because? The heat? The sunlight or something?
Precisely. You're in the middle of nowhere. The water's questionable. You don't have a filter. You want to minimize the bacteria in there, you fill it three-quarters of the way full, you shake it, you fill it, cap it, and then you put it on a roof exposed to the sun for 6 to 8 hours.
Because that sunlight, that UV can dissect a lot.
Precisely, the UVA, and yeah. you break down the oxygen molecule, you create O3, which is a great sanitizer, which is ozone.
Ozone. Brilliant. So that's why it's three-quarters full, so it has a little bit of air to work with.
Or three-quarters full, and then you cap it and shake it so you fill it with oxygen.
Right.
So that you can create the O3.
Oh, brilliant.
But small things like that that we're coming up with, you know, that are so important. You know, we're kind of spoiled in our country, the United States.
Oh, yes.
Because water has always been
so abundant,
pretty readily available and abundant to us.
Yeah.
However, you know, that picture is rapidly changing.
How so?
Well, through the pollution, the drying up of the aquifers.
Mm-hmm. Gee, let's pipe all that water mm-hmm. that sits below a desert up to the surface, and let's grow, you know, golf courses, lawns.
Oh,
gee, what a brilliant, let's have fountains that, you know, just evaporate the water. Gee, what brilliant uses for this. Let's think about seven generations in the future who may need that water.
Yes.
Forget them. Let's just use it all up now.
Well, I feel that as we enter this water age, and hopefully a water awakening occurs, a water consciousness, yes, those practices will be seen as being very archaic, primitive,
barbaric,
and unsupportive of the success of civilization. So, yes, golf courses, we do not need golf courses to survive on the planet.
Mm-mm.
We do need water. We do need food. And many other things are waste of water individually in our own homesteads. So, yes, the water consciousness hopefully will begin to permeate all of society.
You know, and I keep waiting for an administration that will say, you know, let's conserve our resources and let's look for other alternatives to oil. Let's go into alternative energy big time with the know-how and the ingenuity of America. Let's see if we can, you know, wean ourselves off this. You know, let's see if we can clean up the water of ourselves and the world around us and develop alternate technologies that don't pollute.
You know, water consciousness, I feel it's a grassroots thing that will occur, Laura Lee, and that will be our salvation. I mean, when we're looking at the future of life here on the planet, we're looking at the management of the rivers and the groundwaters of our various countries. Here in the United States, our depletion of our groundwater has been sinful.
How long does it take geologically to accumulate aquifers? And how special are they? They're not everywhere. You have to have a certain strata beneath you to fill up, to become an aquifer. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, what are we wholesale in a few decades draining that took millions of years to accumulate?
Very true. Right now in the United States, we're looking at the depletion of our groundwater aquifers. About 50% of the people in the United States depend on groundwater for their drinking water.
50%?
Yes.
Oh, my.
And about 32% in other countries, about 70% in Europe. But the United States, about 50% of our water. And I would assume in Washington, in the rural areas, many people are still on well water and using well water, which if it's in a location that does not have industrial pollution, that historically has not been exposed to contaminants, then, yeah, they're probably getting very good water.
But everybody's driving around and you know, with a gasoline that had that contaminant, so it's seeping into everywhere.
Well, yes, it's seeping into the groundwater mostly because of the tanks that have leaked in the underground fuel tanks.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, if you do have a website that people can go to, it's sponsored by the National Groundwater Association, is www.wellowner.org.
Okay.
And they can get information on wells there. But if you have your private well supply and it's good, believe me, you're very blessed.
Yeah.
Certainly is better than drinking city water that's been going through pipes for miles and miles and sitting in the standpipes and has flocculants and fluoride and chlorine added to it, believe me.
What was the first one? Flocculants? What's that?
Flocculants, it's a chemical additive that they put in to gather together, for instance, iron bacteria so that they form a bigger mass so that they can be basically filtered.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
But, yes, so we are entering a phase, I think, where we're going to see whether or not which countries survive or fail economically will depend on their management or the availability of water to them.
So if you want to be rich in resources in the future, you'll start paying attention to your resources today and protecting them.
So true. That's why they have the big controversy in Canada at this time, because Canada, which is, I would say, the Saudi Arabia of the world when it comes to fresh water supplies, it really is in a position to be one of the wealthiest countries in the world if they are to sell their water. And that is a big controversy there. They have the Council of Canadians. It's a group of about 100,000 people who are posturing themselves to keep their government from selling the water, the Canadian water, around the world.
Mm-hmm. Boy.
And, you know, Worley, this makes so much sense. You said it earlier about working with nature and how important it is to learn from nature and to use water at the source. And I cannot emphasize that myself. I think it is so important. Are you familiar with a basic law of physics called the law of energy conservation?
Yeah, I think most of us are.
And, well, basically what it says is that you cannot destroy energy. Energy
just
only
changes
transforms
form.
Into another form of energy.
Yeah.
So if you water, which is the energy that runs our atmosphere, that runs our rivers, that keeps us alive, if we mismanage that energy, where is that going to go? When you build a dam, all of the energy, that life-giving energy that would flow down that river and supply all of those living organisms and those watersheds in the ocean with energy to survive, to thrive, we put it behind a dam. Where does that energy go?
Hmm.
Of course, there's the loss of living energy. But then you have pressure on the Earth plates, and then you have evaporation going into the atmosphere. So we're transferring this powerful energy of water into places where it can cause a lot of harm, and it is.
You know, we think of it as being a closed system, too, in terms of we have only so much water on the planet. And I know you mentioned in the book, we interviewed Lewis Frank about the cosmic rain from comets and from space raining down.
Very good,
yeah. So apparently we have a new supply of water, but it's not something you can go and pipe in. Let's have cosmic rain that we can pipe into our source. And you would think that a planet that's three-quarters water, that we would have plenty of it. And yet, we are going to be running out of clean sources of water if we're not paying attention today.
Very true. And, you know, we're constantly, Laura-Lee, we're constantly learning more about water each day, like Emoto's work in Japan.
Oh, isn't that fascinating?
Isn't that fascinating? Well, basically, his work is corroborating what the ancients have been telling us all along relative to healing and relative to water, but he has corroborated it with science, and he basically took a sample of water, split it into several samples, and had people project various thoughts into each sample, like negative, violent thoughts into one sample in one room, and then they'd go into another room, project loving, caring thoughts, and then one sample would have nothing done to it. And then he would freeze these three water samples and look at the crystals. And the water sample that received the negative violent thoughts, the crystals were malformed and they weren't as plentiful. And then when you would freeze the sample that had the loving, caring thoughts projected into it, the crystals were all fully formed and energized and were plentiful.
It gives you a whole new definition of purity, doesn't it?
Purity and our relationship to water. I mean, water is alive. It responds to our emotions.
Victor Schauberger talked a lot about that too, didn't he? And how it energizes the life around it.
Yes, it is alive. It has to be alive. It gives birth to life. It sustains life.
It's a pretty unusual substance. You know, most solids don't float in the liquid like ice does. You know, without the special properties of water, this planet wouldn't be so potent with life. You talk about how water's so necessary. We are like walking vials of water, or a collection of little vials bundled together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
yes,
in
are.
Our cells. These little oceans in our cells. And you say that we lose 18% of our water in our cells by age 80 if you're not really hydrating yourself. So a lot of aging is just dehydration.
A lot of aging, a lot of painful aging occurs because of dehydration.
Yeah.
As we age, our senses become worn down. I mean, these are our senses that indicate to us, for instance, that we're thirsty.
Hmm.
People who do not continually and habitually hydrate themselves by drinking proper amounts of water each day, each and every day, good quality water, are doing themselves a great disservice.
Yeah.
You know, just through perspiration, we lose 2 to 3 quarts of water every day.
Hmm. Wow.
So, you know, each one of us, the average person, should drink between 2 to 3.5 quarts a day. That's the average person, depending on your weight and how active you are. Is another thing, if you're stressed, certainly you should be drinking more water. If you're depressed, my God, yes, drink loads of water.
What has water got to do with depression, the workings of the brain?
Workings of the brain, precisely. Hmm. And also the health, the overall energy of all the cells in your body.
Yeah.
So very, very, very important.
We think of water as a carrier medium, but not as a nutrient. I think it really is a nutrient, at least good water.
Yes, it is very much a nutrient. It's a conveyor of nutrition, without a doubt. It puts the nutrients that we need into solutions so they can be absorbed by plants, and then we eat the plants, and therefore we gather those energies that the water puts into solution in the ground. So that's our connection with the earth that is brought into us by water.
But so many of the esoteric scientists like Schauberger and others looked at some special magical quality to water itself, or that it was a carrier for the life force. They say that about homeopathy. It is really a carrier of the vibration, similar to Emoto's work, and that this can also energize you, this energy that water can be a carrier of.
That's true. Water has memory.
Water has memory. Explain that. Yeah.
That's one thing we're aware of. That's the basis for homeopathy, where you would take something that would otherwise be lethal, like belladonna, and you put in a small portion of the belladonna into your water carrier, and then you keep diluting a fraction of that, until you get to a point where belladonna is no longer present in the water, but the electrical memory of the belladonna that was picked up by the water molecules remains. And that is the entire basis for homeopathy. But to the flip side of that, that's the side for healing. But if you want to go to the flip side of that, when you're talking about engineering and technology cleaning our water, as far as water treatment is concerned and purifying water, using the science what I call archaic science, or the science of yesterday, or mechanical science, they remove what they can measure chemically out of the water, but the electrical frequencies, the oscillations, and the specific frequency bands or wavelengths of the pollutants remain in the water. And therefore, that responds to our electrical makeup in our bodies. So, there are many things that we are still learning. And I think we're entering this age of water. And in this age of water, we're going to begin to see that, hey, if we work with water, we have a potential here of allowing civilization to move forward. I think that is our biggest challenge at this time. These decisions we make relative to water management and individually as to what we do with water in our homes and what we do with water that we take into our bodies is just so vital at this stage of history.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ancients were very good at using hydrotherapy. They knew about water being used therapeutically. I was in Egypt and saw hydrotherapy basins that were pointed out by our guides. Just sitting in warm water has a very therapeutic effect. And isn't it interesting? I know the you must have also looked into the theory of the fact that humankind, according to some people, spent some time in shallow seas, and that's why we have such an affinity to water and have less body hair and have more of a fat layer for insulation and all of that. Look at watery mammals, and you look at human beings, and we have some characteristics in common.
So true, yes.
Yeah. That must have intrigued you with your love of
that's
water.
That is the theory of the water ape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, of any of the mammals on the planet, especially the terrestrial mammals, we are extremely sensitive beings. Yes, we are quite hairless. We are quite unique. We're very sensitive. And we have this tremendous power because of our brain power, where most of our water goes anyhow into our brains.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, our brains are well supplied with all that.
And talking about depression earlier, yes, I can relate to someone being in the desert and being very dehydrated. And let's say they come across an oasis, or someone riding a camel finds them and they have a water skin. So upon drinking water, you can be close to being delirious. But as soon as you take a couple of mouthfuls of water, it's sublingually, just through your tongue, immediately the water will go to your brain to give you consciousness so that you can be sharp and awake and help you to survive. And also, when you're becoming dehydrated, you will sacrifice water in various parts of your body just so that the brain and the heart can maintain you to help your living being survive. Of course, all the civilizations of the world originated around water.
Yeah.
Yes, there is something to that affinity of human beings and water. And we've kind of divorced ourselves from that. And especially in modern history. In fact, modern man in this portion of my book, I write about modern man, how many of people in urban situations spend a lot of their lives in non-living environments, in their home, in the streets they walk, in the subways and buses, and in their offices. They'll spend the majority of their life here in their earthly journey on the planet, in this region, and as far as we can tell, in relative to many regions near us. But life is here, and we are a part of life. But why would a living entity, in their passage through this rare living entity, this planet that has life, why would we divorce ourselves from it and spend the majority of our life in places where there's no life?
No plants and no open sky and no earth beneath our feet but concrete, right?
Yeah, so consider, here you're placed in this gem of a living planet throughout the universe. And if we have a soul, we come here to, I feel, experience life. And my, what a journey we have. And we know that water collects memories, and we are mostly water. So, yeah, we collect these memories in our passage through this living world. And what a great amount of memories to collect of all these beautiful life forms, to share time with them, to look at them, to wonder about them, all the trees, the plants.
We're like Bubble Boy, right? We just
swim in clean water.
Oh,
yeah,
off.
Think about it. And then if you, after you leave and you enter that next phase of infinity, you're taking all these beautiful living memories with you. Now, the poor person who passed through this living world, and the only memories they can take for most of their life has been sitting in these boxes with no living entities to share time with. I mean, what a penance, what torment that you're not carrying with you all these memories you could have collected from this living world.
Boy. Yeah, you know, the ancients felt that the earth was a womb, was mother, was the nurture. We don't look at earth like that anymore. It's like, stay back, right?
Oh, yes. So
I don't want to get dirty. I don't want to get rained on. I don't want to get cold. I don't want to, you know, wild animals. Oh, they spook me. Yeah. We are odd, aren't we? Creatures. How
what
did
has happened now? We didn't always, we, you know, this
how
is a relatively new phenomenon, Laurie.
Oh, boy. Yeah. You know, you also talk about Hans Jenny, and we've looked a lot into Jenny's work and looking at the sound vibration and healing. We'll be talking with Jonathan Goldman, I think tomorrow, looking at sound healing. And what does it do? You point out it's activating those vials of water that are in our cells. So we have millions of little cells being activated by sound, by, you know, consciousness, prayer, all of this. No wonder it works. No wonder all of these ancient healing practices work.
Well, yes, on a
we can understand
basis.
It. Yeah.
We have the mitochondria, which is in the shape of a musical instrument. We have about 100 to 1,000 of those. In the mitochondria, we have 100 to 1,000 of those in each and every one of our cells in our bodies, but they're in the shape of a musical instrument, like
which
a guitar
one?
Or a violin.
Uh-huh.
And that's where all the chemical processes within the cell take place, within the mitochondria. But the mitochondria, because of their shape, they respond to sound. They vibrate. So if the sound that they are receiving is conducive for your healing, then you're creating that vibration on a subcellular basis, which in turn enhances the chemical activity of the mitochondria through the waves, the sound waves, and creates these little vortices within the cell and the intracellular water. So basically, you're creating a healing through that sound wave from, on a subcellular basis.
Brilliant, isn't it? Aren't we beautifully designed?
Well, we're designed, you know, and to take that, that's the micro.
Yeah.
But to go to the macro, and I sincerely feel this, Laurie, you know, we can take sound waves, take the waves of our energy thoughts, and then with those waves from our energy, from our minds, it travels along these microtubules of water around our nerves and then translates, which allows us to transform this reality around us and to create things like artists do, engineers. But looking on a macro basis, I sincerely feel that this universe was created by a thought based from water intelligence, a thought wave.
Mm, interesting.
And it's maintained by water intelligence, which we participate with.
So water would be the universal source, and scientists have found the imprint, the electromagnetic imprint of water all around us, out there in the universe at large. Thank you for a wonderful book that you put together and for this conversation, William.
Likewise, Lily.
Appreciate it. Carry on.
You too.
Please help the planet realize we need to protect and utilize our water resources to their utmost potential and good. William's book is The Holy Order of Water, Healing Earth's Waters and Ourselves. May we do so in future. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.